From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, William Masters, Virginia Johnson, and Robert Kolodny defend their controversial new book on heterosexual behavior in the age of AIDS. Also today, I speak with character comedian Jeffrey Essman. He mocks everything from New Age spirituality to one-man shows. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the New York Dolls, the glitter band from the 70s that launched the career of singer David Johansen, who's now better known as Buster Poindexter. And book critic John Leonard reviews S, John Updike's retelling of Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Doctors William Masters, Virginia Johnson, and Robert Kolodny, three experts in the field of sexual behavior, have just released a new study about heterosexual behavior in the age of AIDS. Their book is titled Crisis. According to their study, AIDS has established a beachhead in the heterosexual population, and the odds are the rate of spread among heterosexuals will begin to increase at a frightening pace. The methodology and conclusions of this study have provoked widespread criticism from the medical and scientific communities. The New York Times just published an editorial criticizing the study for reviving old fears about AIDS while ignoring empirical evidence that put those fears to rest. A little later, we'll hear from a California AIDS researcher who is also studying the spread of AIDS among heterosexuals. She questions the validity of the Masters-Johnson-Kolodny study. I spoke with Masters Johnson and Kolodny from the NPR studios in New York. Kolodny began by discussing what he thinks is the most important finding of their study.
The most important finding of the research is a confirmation in our minds that among a group of heterosexuals without risk factors from the original high-risk groups for AIDS infection, that is homosexual contact, bisexual male contact, or use of intravenous drugs, or having received a blood transfusion in the preceding 10 years, that there was a higher than expected rate of infection with the AIDS virus that correlated with the number of annual sexual partners. Not a surprising finding in terms of it matches with what is already known about hepatitis B, about gonorrhea, and about many other sexually transmitted diseases. But until this study took place, there was no targeted data on a comparable non-clinical population showing that in the heterosexual community, this was existing beyond the minimal levels that have been reported, for instance, in the military screening programs or the blood bank screening programs, which do not, of course, gather behavioral data on the frequency or parameters of heterosexual activity of the millions of people who are screened there.
I think that there are at least two major issues within the realm of the question, is AIDS spreading into the heterosexual community? And one is heterosexual sex an easy way to spread the disease? And the other is, has the virus entered the heterosexual community so that it is being passed on from heterosexual partners to one another? Do you think that your study furthers the information in either of these areas? Do you think that we're learning more about how easily the virus is spread in the act of heterosexual sex and how much the virus has entered the heterosexual community?
The difficulty with the question of how the spread is occurring is that it will require a type of study that hasn't yet been done. A prospective study done over time, that is a study that follows a group of heterosexuals over a 2 to 3 year period that monitors their sexual behavior and the spread of the virus. It's virtually impossible right now to distinguish, to tease out how many cases of heterosexual infection originated from so-called secondary spread, that is, the sex partner of an IV drug user or the sex partner of a bisexual man, and how much is in so-called tertiary dimension, meaning between heterosexuals with no known risk factor whatsoever. That's the big question confronting us. On the question of the ease of a heterosexual single encounter transmitting the virus. I'll turn that one over to Dr. Masters.
Well, the single encounter is a rather rare thing. But, for instance, if one knows that one's having sexual activity with an individual who has the disease, has the virus, the percentage chance of the partner being contaminated for the female is 1 in 400, and for the male, approximately 1 in 600 opportunities.
Which means that this is not an easily transmitted sexual disease in the sense that, for instance, gonorrhea would be. And yet, because the stakes are so much higher with this disease, the question of ease of transmission has to be put into the context of the seriousness of the consequences.
I think that's so important to emphasize. After all, we're not dealing with something that can be taken care of with a shot of penicillin or two. What we're talking about is something that, as everyone knows, is indeed, at the present, a fatal disease once it's been established.
Let me put it this way. In your book, you say that AIDS has established a beachhead within the heterosexual community, and it's going to start increasing in the heterosexual community in alarming numbers. I mean, Dr. Galadny, what are you predicting?
We're predicting, well, first, we are basing our statement of an established beachhead in the heterosexual community among estimates from a number of different studies, including many studies, at least half a dozen, of pregnant women who are clearly heterosexual, almost by definition, one might add, that would indicate to us that there are currently at least 200,000 infected heterosexuals, not cases of AIDS, but heterosexuals infected with the AIDS virus. Once that large a number has been reached, and with the knowledge that we gleaned from our own study, that among the group of people sometimes having 10, 15, 20, or 50 partners a year, that is a group, because of their large number of partners, more apt to spread the virus, more apt to expose others to it. We believe that if nothing is done dramatically in terms of public education, other public health programs, and legislative efforts, that if things are left as they are, these numbers will only escalate, because as the CDC itself has observed, in an epidemic, as the prevalence of an infection begins to increase, the risk to everybody who comes in contact with those infected people begins to heighten as well.
So you're concerned primarily about, in the heterosexual population, you're concerned primarily about people who have multiple partners every year.
This is exactly the case of the most rapid spread in the gay community as well, in the initial stages.
Yes, I think that's so important because what we're really dealing with is all we're seeing is reduplication of sexual practices in the heterosexual community with the type of practice, the cruising, that got was primarily responsible for the early spread of the virus in the homosexual community.
Let me reintroduce you all. My guests are Dr. William Masters, Virginia Johnson, and Robert Kolodny, three doctors who are the co-authors of the new book, Crisis, Heterosexual Behavior in the Age of AIDS. As you've probably heard by now, the book is very controversial, and their findings are being criticized, condemned, and contested within the medical community. The reaction has been loud, and in many areas, the reaction has been very negative to the book. Let's look specifically at the sample that you used to conduct your research. There were 800 people, 400 monogamous heterosexuals, and 400 heterosexuals who had multiple partners. In the population of people who you studied, can you describe their sexual practices as compared to the sexual practices in a more general population?
In the group with a large number of partners, it would certainly be true that they were somewhat more adventuresome sexually and engaged in a greater breadth of types of sexual activity and perhaps a somewhat higher frequency with certain activities, particularly anal intercourse.
What's the average number of sexual partners per year that the people in your study had?
It was approximately 12 for the non-monogamous group. It was approximately 12 per year for the women and 10 per year for the men.
Now, your findings are being criticized because, A, these aren't random people. They're not scientifically random. You found your subjects by advertising for them in singles bars and places like that. So you have a very kind of skewed representation of the public. How do you defend the way that you've chosen the subjects for your sample?
I think one of the best ways to defend it is to point out that in the book we make it exquisitely clear that this is not a random sample.
Beyond that, the difficulty in the whole field is that there has been no random sample done in any aspect of investigating the prevalence of AIDS. That's one of the biggest difficulties confronting scientists. Certainly, we wish we had been able to do it. We didn't have the resources. And if the CDC and major universities haven't been able to either, we plead guilty to the charge that it's not random, but point out that there hasn't been one done yet in that fashion.
Now, let me just clarify something. You found that 6% of your group became infected with AIDS. So this is 6%.
No, with the AIDS virus.
With the AIDS
not
virus.
With AIDS.
Okay.
And 6% of the group of 400 people with numerous sexual partners. In the monogamous group of 400 people, it was overall only a quarter of 1% that was infected.
So you would say that the application of this study is that if you generalize from this, that 6% of the population who is very heterosexually active with multiple partners might be in jeopardy?
No. Because the sample wasn't a random sample, we can't make that concrete and direct a generalization. Had we done the study in a half a million people, perhaps we could have made a stronger statement. All we can say is that there appears to be a strong correlation between the presence of the virus, the infection, in heterosexuals with large number of sexual partners, and that in those in monogamous relationships, it seems to be a very minimal occurrence.
So you're saying that the evidence indicates that it's appropriate to take more precautions than we're taking, but it's not appropriate to really make large generalizations yet.
Well, is that
I'm not sure of what you're saying, because on the one hand you're saying that the study counts, and on the other hand you're saying that you can't really generalize from it.
That's exactly right. We said both. There's no question that one can't generalize from the study because it's not a random sample. On the other hand, one can learn from the study. What the study really only requires, screens for, is a random sampling of a lot of subjects. And one, it's certainly beyond our, as Dr. Gladney pointed out, our financial capability to do. It is really, to get back to the cases, the responsibility of government organizations to do that. That's where the money is, and it has not been done. And that's what we're trying to point out. Ours is but a pilot study. We've never claimed anything else. End results to be determined only after one follows up in the pilot study with definitive objective research.
Okay, well, to get to some of your controversial reporting about how AIDS is spread, after we take a short break, and my guests are Drs. William Masters, Virginia Johnson, and Robert Kolodny, author of the new, very controversial book, Crisis: Heterosexual Behavior in the Age of AIDS. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guests are Drs. William Masters, Virginia Johnson, and Robert Kolodny, and we're talking about their new controversial findings on heterosexual behavior and AIDS. Now, you make many controversial, very strong statements about how AIDS can be spread. For instance, you talk about how AIDS could perhaps be spread by kissing, and you say that there's really not been any identified cases in which kissing was the primary means of the transmission of the virus. But then you say, but shouldn't we be adapting precautions against the worst case possibility rather than making the most optimistic assumption? So what I come away with from your study is that, as far as we know, AIDS has never been spread by kissing. But theoretically, maybe it could be, so shouldn't we really worry about it and act accordingly?
Yes.
It's a little confusing to me because on the one hand, we have no evidence it's been spread that way, and on the other hand, you're really promoting this fear that AIDS can be spread by kissing.
Let me suggest this context for understanding that. If a person is in a relationship with a sexual partner who is infected, where research has clearly identified that live virus can be present in saliva, we think that most prudent doctors would actually recommend that such a couple be extremely cautious about deep kissing that would involve the exchange of saliva because of the possibility of infection occurring through a cut or nick or blister or rash inside the uninfected partner's mouth, providing a means of entry for the virus. The general population, not infected, clearly doesn't have to worry about this issue. We raise the point not only that there are no proven cases, which we stated and concur with, but also that the likelihood of ever being able to prove in a real-life situation that a person was infected by kissing would be so extraordinarily difficult that even if it was occurring once in 100,000 or once in 1,000,000 times, there would be no way to document that. How could you find a person who had only engaged in kissing and no other sexual contact? It would be an epidemiologist's nightmare. We are not meaning to be alarmists, but we are meaning to say that to dismiss absolutely the possibility that there could ever be transmission by kissing is to be playing an undefensible scientific position just to cheer up the public.
You've also studied the behavior of heterosexuals in the age of AIDS.
Yes.
What have you found about how sexual conduct is changing? Do you find that people are practicing abstinence more or using protections like condoms more?
I think that there is always a segment of the population that is a thinking, well-considered attitude toward their sexual behavior, toward their relationships. But there is so much evidence that large numbers of people are continuing to do what they have always done, either through a feeling of individual invincibility. You see, we have a very strong belief, and our 30-plus years of work in this field has led us to respond to the public's need to know. We feel that an informed, knowledgeable population is one that can make choices. So we don't censor or sit in defense or criticism, I should say, of those people who still advertise very freely in New York, for instance, the Village Voice, in St. Louis, our own city, and the Riverfront Times, and I'm sure this is fairly generalized over the country, advertising for partners that are unknown, strangers to join them in sexual relationships or events. There's a lot of this that still prevails, and many of these people live a rather dual life. And consequently, if they are informed, and if they choose to continue to do this, fine. But I'm afraid there isn't enough behavior change that we can be sure of at this time.
We know a question that a lot of people who aren't in monogamous relationships have is, if I meet someone who I want to engage in sexual relations with, how do I know if they have the virus? How do I know if I'll be protected if we have sex? You make a recommendation that basically two people who come together in a new relationship who've had previous sexual encounters get tested for AIDS and then abstain for 6 months, you know, before they have sex. Would you explain that recommendation?
The reason for the six-month waiting period before having both partners in the couple be tested a second time is that it has been shown that in a certain number of cases of infection, it takes months for the antibody response to reach a measurable level, so that it is possible, for instance, if a man and woman meet and they had each had other partners 2 months before, they could on that day test as seronegative, and yet virus could be in their body, they could be infected, one or the other, and therefore could be placing the partner at risk. the rationale for waiting for the 6 months is that that would cover the great majority of cases in which it takes time for the antibody to develop. Interestingly, after we wrote that recommendation approximately 5 months ago when we were preparing the manuscript, the CDC and the American Fertility Society, among others, have just come out in the last 2 weeks and issued the identical recommendation for sperm donor programs. That is, before being able to use a sperm specimen, which in some ways is similar in the exposure to the virus, the donor must be tested, the sperm specimen must be frozen and stored for 6 months, and then the donor must be tested a second time, and only if the second test is negative is the sperm specimen to be released. That's now suggested government policy on sperm donor programs. So apparently there was some sensibility to the recommendation, but interestingly, despite our having already given dozens and dozens of interviews, you're the first person who's asked us about that very practical and, we think, useful point of advice geared to the millions of people who are in the situation you mention.
We're about out of time, so let me ask you one last question. Based on the results of your study, what advice would you like to give heterosexuals, because your study is about heterosexuals, and what kind of action do you think the government should perhaps be taking that it's not?
First, the government has to do an objective study of what we did as a pilot study. Number two, we certainly have to practice safer sex, as described here. And number three, we think that required and mandatory testing in the number of situations that we outlined is a vital public health protection.
Okay, well, I thank you all for talking with us. Thank you.
It's been a
Thanks
pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
That was William Masters, Virginia Johnson, and Robert Kolodny, authors of the new book Crisis: Heterosexual Behavior in the Age of AIDS. The spread of AIDS in the heterosexual population is also the subject of a study now underway at the University of California at Berkeley's School of Health. It's known as the California Partner Study, and the project director is Nancy Padian, a research epidemiologist. The study is investigating the transmission of the AIDS virus in heterosexual couples where one of the partners is infected with the AIDS virus or has tested positive for the HIV antibody. I asked Padian what preliminary results she could draw from her study.
My data is most thorough in male-to-female transmission, and over about 140 female partners of infected men, approximately 23 to 24% themselves are infected. And factors that seem to increase the likelihood of infection are the practice of anal intercourse. However, I want to stress that it's not necessary for it to occur. I mean, women who have practiced anal intercourse in addition to vaginal intercourse have a higher chance of becoming infected, but there's women in the study who have become infected who have only practiced vaginal intercourse. Another interesting finding is the heterogeneity having related to infectiousness, where some people seem to become infected based on only a few contacts with their infected partner, whereas other people remain uninfected in spite of large numbers of contacts. And I think this is an area where we're going to see a lot of study trying to pinpoint factors that are associated with transmission to help us better predict why transmission occurs in some instances and not in other instances.
So you are finding, then, that AIDS can be transmitted sexually between heterosexuals, that it's more likely to occur, it's more likely to get transmitted through anal intercourse, but it can get transmitted through intercourse involving the penis and the vagina.
Right. I mean, no, I don't think anyone's disputing whether it can occur, but studies like mine aren't going to tell you about what the prevalence is of heterosexually exposed people in the country. I mean, I enroll people who definitely have a verified infected partner. And the question is, you know, well, what proportion of heterosexual people have infected partners that may not know? And that's something you're not going to get from my study. But I think where scientists are taking issue with the Masters and Johnson's results, or at least what they're doing with their results, how they're interpreting their results, is that there has not been a lot of evidence of heterosexual spread of the disease beyond partners of people in initial risk groups. So while partners of intravenous drug users themselves have become infected and partners of bisexual men, we see very little of next, of tertiary spread, where those infected partners then turn around and infect their other partners.
So you disagree with Masters at Johnson and Kolodny, who say that AIDS has established a beachhead in the heterosexual community?
Well, I'd have to know what they mean by the heterosexual community. I mean, I think that there are certain minority inner-city areas where, particularly among the partners of intravenous drug users, you do see a heterosexual spread. But again, you see very little of this tertiary spread, so they would have to define what they mean by the heterosexual population. It's a very heterogeneous thing, and if they're talking about the partners of IV drug users, then I would say, yes, they're right. But if they're talking about middle-class Caucasian people who don't have direct contact with people who are in a known risk group, then I would take issue with it.
They are, by the way, talking about that latter group.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
See, I haven't read the book. I've only read the media, how the media has presented the group. If they're talking about that latter group, then I would take issue with it.
They're talking about largely white, middle class, people who have not been exposed, or at least do not admit being exposed to homosexuals, bisexuals,
or intravenous drug users,
yeah.
Well, then I would take issue with if that's how they're defining the heterosexual population. And in fact, when I talked about this before, where there have been other samples looked at that are derived from clinics where people get treatment for sexually transmitted diseases, many of them have been in clinics that are based in cities where there is a fair amount of partners of IV drug users and a fair amount of people in initial risk groups. And the fact that those samples are in areas where there already is a higher prevalence of infection and they're still finding lower rates of infection in those samples, I think, once again, you would want to know a lot more about their data collection methods and their interpretation of their results. Again, bear in mind that I haven't read the book. I've only read summaries of the books in the media.
So if I understand you correctly, from your research, you're finding that the virus can, in fact, be spread through heterosexual
right.
sex, but that the patterns of transmission are showing that really the only way it seems to be ending up in the heterosexual population is through heterosexuals having sex with people who are homosexual, bisexual,
right.
or
right
IV drug
now,
users.
That's what we're seeing. But keep in mind, you see, there's a lot of factors in predicting how something is going to spread. One is, you want to establish biological plausibility that it can, in fact, be transmitted. And yes, my study has done that. It can. And lots of other studies have done that, too. The other thing you need to know is the prevalence of the virus in the communities. What is the likelihood that you're going to have contact with an infected partner? And then the other thing is, what is the infectivity? Given the fact that there's a certain probability that you're going to have an infected partner, what is the likelihood that upon exposure to that partner that you're going to become infected? So there's a lot of variables involved in trying to get a picture of what's going on over the population, not simply the fact that it can occur.
Given what you know and what you know about the general research and of your own research, do you recommend that heterosexuals who are not monogamous practice safe sex at this point in time?
Yeah, I do. See, because even though I disagree with what Masters and Johnson's conclude, I still think they should, because this is a lethal disease and there is no cure. And even if your chance is 1 in 1 million or 1 in 100,000, once, the only sure way to prevent against getting AIDS is to not get infected to begin with. And it seems to me you've got to err on the side of caution that incorporating safer sex practices into normal, healthy sexual behavior is not a lot to ask. It's a protective thing not only for AIDS, but for other sexually transmitted diseases as well. And I would recommend that, yes.
Nancy Padian is the project director of the California Partner Study. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actress Ruby Dee. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we enter the world of character comedian Jeffrey Essman, a world in which the audience becomes, in turn, diners at a New Age restaurant, students at Catholic school, and participants in a lecture on cow psychology. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the New York Dolls, the band that pushed glitter rock to new extremes. And book critic John Leonard reviews John Updike's new novel, S. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. Tennessee Senator Albert Gore appears to be the winner of the Democratic primary in Kentucky tonight, and it looks like Vice President George Bush has won the Republican primary. With nearly 50% of the precincts reporting, Bush was way ahead of his nearest rival Robert Dole, leading Dole 58-23%. Former TV evangelist Pat Robertson is running third. In the Democratic contest, Michael Dukakis is in second place. Jesse Jackson is third. Jackson is projected the winner in Georgia and Virginia. Dukakis appears headed for victory in Florida. Jackson and Bush will be watching the primary returns from Houston tonight. As NPR's John Burnett reports, Texas is the biggest prize of the 20 Super Tuesday contests.
183 Democratic delegates will be selected in Texas, but only two-thirds of them will be known tonight. The rest will be chosen according to a complex apportionment system that begins at precinct caucuses, which meet around the state after the polls close at 7 o'clock. In contrast, all 111 Republican delegates will be selected tonight. If one Republican candidate wins more than 50%, he gets all the delegates in that district. Bush is already heavily favored over Robertson and Dole in Texas. His supporters hope the Republicans' winner-take-all system will give him a clean sweep in Texas. George Bush cast his vote this morning at a Houston hotel. He then took the day off to be with his wife at their Texas residence, a suite at the Houstonian Hotel. Jesse Jackson is expected to show up here at the Albert Thomas Convention Center downtown. The latest Texas poll shows Jackson still trailing Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, but Jackson supporters say stay tuned, the night might hold some surprises. In Houston, this is John Burnett reporting.
Federal workers at the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard in Washington State today lost their bid to speak freely at tonight's presidential caucuses. Ann Martin of member station KPLU has details.
2 weeks ago, the Navy warned 11,000 of its civilian workers at the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard that the Hatch Act prohibits them from speaking for or against a presidential candidate in tonight's presidential caucuses. Shipyard workers in the state of Washington tried to get a restraining order that would have reversed the Navy's restriction. But this morning, federal judge Jack Tanner denied that motion. The Hatch Act allows federal workers to go to caucuses and vote. However, without the ability to speak freely, one labor official representing 14,000 federal employees predicts that, for the most part, workers for the U.S. government in Washington state will choose not to attend tonight's caucuses. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Martin in Seattle.
A Jewish settler in the West Bank shot and killed a Palestinian protester today. The Israeli army says it's investigating the incident. At a West Bank refugee camp, Palestinians stabbed to death an Arab policeman suspected of cooperating with Israeli authorities. The victim's body was later dumped at his mother's door. Meanwhile, four army officers were sentenced today to 35 days in jail for being unarmed when three guerrillas commandeered their car yesterday before hijacking an Israeli bus. The Federal Aviation Administration today announced a year-long investigation of the nation's commuter airline industry. The probe will focus on compliance with federal safety rules and regulations following a recent rash of fatal commuter plane crashes. John Layden is an FAA spokesman in Washington.
In the last 6 months or so, we've seen five or six commuter airline accidents, and I think we've had over 50 fatalities. So that is a matter of concern to us. So we say we need to take a special look at this. The industry, to see if there is some type of connecting thread. Maybe the rules or regulations need to be strengthened in certain areas.
The FAA says the commuter safety record in recent months runs counter to significant improvements in the airline industry overall. Stock prices advanced today to their highest level since the October stock market crash. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 24 points to close at 2081.07. Advances led declines more than 2-1 in heavy trading of 237 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. David Johansen now performs in the persona of Buster Poindexter, a lounge lizard-type crooner who has attracted an enthusiastic following in the pop music world. But before he slipped into Buster's skin, Johansen was the frontman for a proto-punk band called the New York Dolls. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says their initial sound and style gave new energy to the music.
Come on, boys!
It was 1973, and to a lot of us who had been following rock and roll for some time, it looked pretty apparent that rot was setting in. The Beatles were being deified by people who had held their noses when they'd first come on the scene, and the Rolling Stones were the oh-so-decadent darlings of high society. Bands like Yes and Emerson, Lake & Palmer were threatening to bury us under albums full of pretentious sludge. The alternative was the high-volume, low-IQ sound of bands like Grand Funk Railroad. A lot of us agreed that what we needed was a nice infusion of trash.
Trash won't pick it up. Take them lights away. Trash won't pick it up. Don't take your life away. Trash won't pick it up. Don't try to take my knife away. And please don't you ask me if I love you. If you don't know what I'm doing, what you know is trash.
New York Dolls were made to order. They arose out of the Mercer Arts Center, a performance space that had become New York's hot avant-garde location. It was too hard to get a rock and roll scene going in Manhattan's clubs, thanks to the oppressive cabaret card laws, but this bunch of malcontents was doing just fine at the Mercer. They shared space there with another band called Kiss. Critics dismissed Kiss when they noticed them at all, but they loved the Dolls. Frontman David Johansen took sexual ambiguity further than Mick Jagger had dared, and Johnny Thunders, the guitarist, looked and acted more like Keith Richards than Keith ever hoped to. No record company would go near them, although they were packing the Mercer with the New York hip wazee night after night. They'd alternate their own originals with oldies from Johansen's record collection, like Bo Diddley's Pills. Unfortunately, the drug humor, which was cool for its time, was all too real. The Dolls' first drummer, Billy Mercia, died during their first tour of England of an overdose of pills and alcohol, and both bassist Arthur Kane and guitarist Johnny Thunders have had well-publicized run-ins with heroin. For many people, though, this just solidified the Dolls' reputation as the bad boys of rock and roll, badder than the Stones, even. Finally, Mercury Records decided that the Dolls were worth taking a chance on and signed them. Todd Rundgren produced their first album, and a legend was born.
Thank you.
Songs like Personality Crisis showed that this was a world-class band whose pretensions were limited to the makeup and weird clothing they wore on stage. They toured, and they were roundly hated, except in cities like Detroit, where they liked their rock and roll nasty, and Los Angeles, where they understood somehow what this band was all about. Their second album was entitled Too Much Too Soon, which was intended to be an ironic title but proved to be fairly accurate. There were very few original tunes on it, and if possible, it sold even less than the first album. The Dolls lost their recording contract and soon had a new manager, a British fellow named Malcolm McLaren. He dressed them in red leather and draped a communist Chinese flag behind them. The band broke up before this new image could get too far, and McLaren went on to put the Sex Pistols together. David Johansen made a number of wonderful solo records, which were also ignored. Still, if you hang around Los Angeles these days, you may be shocked to see how many New York Dolls-style bands there are in the clubs. Of course, the original is still the greatest, in my opinion, and I'm glad they were around to help keep rock and roll honest in the bad old days of the 70s.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
And you're a prima ballerina on a spring afternoon. Change on into the Wolfman, howling at the moon. Ow, out of personality crisis, you got it while it was hot. It's always hot, you know, with frustration. Honey, what you got? Half a mouth, how I thought I'd like a criminality. Now with all the crossing fate that Mother Nature sends, your mirror's getting jammed up with all your friends. That personality, every scene ain't starting to blend. Not like one personality when your mind starts to blend.
This is Fresh Air.
There's a lot of love in here tonight. You know, I think if all the leaders of the world could be with us in this room right now, it'd be way too crowded.
When Jeffrey Essman walks on stage, his clean Midwestern looks, sincere expression, and button-down shirt belie the outrageous yet subtle comic characterizations that follow. Using a combination of cheap props and the help of a piano accompanist, Essman transforms himself into a wide range of characters. His sketches are more in the style of Lily Tomlin and Eric Bogosian than stand-up comedy. His oldest character is a tyrannical nun named Sister Bernice, modeled after his fourth-grade parochial school teacher. A newer character is based on a convert to the New Age movement.
You know, I was really very disappointed in that past life guy you recommended to me. Very disappointed. Oh, he had me as a papyrus picker in ancient Egypt. During the French Revolution, I was an accountant. I just don't believe I've been that boring throughout the ages.
How do you like to describe what you're doing in your show?
How do I like to describe it? I get very hesitant just to call it comedy because most people's image of comedy is a stand-up form, which I obviously don't do. Within comedy, I guess it would be branched into character comedy, which, you know, is the sort of stuff that Lily Tomlin does, or I think Richard Pryor does it to some degree also, but his non-stand-up sections when he actually does other characters and things. But I also think it's much more theatrical because it really does come from acting. I was an actor before any of this started. That's why I came to New York, and it was actually an acting teacher who encouraged me to start writing my own material and performing it.
Now, you've never played a nightclub, right?
Oh, I have.
Oh, you have
yeah.
played
nightclubs.
Oh, yeah,
nightclubs. Absolutely. Uh-huh. I've covered really everything. I mean, from a long time in what here is the cabaret circuit, which is really just clubs, and then the regular comedy clubs. Occasionally I would get up there and people would be pleasantly surprised because, you know, it was something different. But more often than not, it was as if I had sort of broken the rule.
So you don't like really playing nightclubs?
Not really.
But you have a character who does play nightclubs. You have a Barbie. You play a Barbie doll at a Barbie nightclub.
Right. She's actually the owner of the club, so she is playing the club, absolutely, yeah.
So what, since Barbie has a car and great clothes, you gave her a nightclub too?
Right, I figured that was sort of the next logical step, that Barbie would have a permanent showcase for her talents. It actually came from another piece that I abandoned that was, I think it was a children's show parody, where I had a puppet show within the piece, and I had a G.I. Joe as a puppet, a Barbie, one of those little artist's models. And in doing the puppet show, what people responded to the most was me playing Barbie. And so I just scrapped the rest of the piece and wrote Barbie something, which initially was Barbie on the phone talking, I think, with Chatty Cathy. And then later I doing the method actor work on Barbie and doing the research and studying her movements, I looked at all the different kinds, like Malibu Barbie and, you know, Black Barbie, all of that. And there's one called Superstar Barbie. And I decided she was the one that I would base the piece on. She came with a little microphone, and I just sort of took it from there.
All they've given me is a beautiful body with no nipples. Oh, and feet that can only wear high heels. And they wonder why I drink.
Since you perform Barbie in a nightclub setting, do you get to do some of the type of club shtick that you really don't like?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the whole beginning section of those bad jokes with the ba-dump bumps and the stuff with her sort of the Ed McMahon figure of Raggedy Andy on the piano. Absolutely, I get to act out all of that. And really all that stuff, because the other part, as Barbie developed, the whole thing about her alcoholism and drug addiction and her bitterness, comes out of the sort of morbid fascination we have for self-destructive performers.
Yeah, you know, in addition to there being these really self-destructive performers who have become heroes, who are literally worshipped by their fans, there's also a lot of really just hopelessly boring cliches about about drunk performers. Right. You know, performers right. Who have, like, taken a dive and now they're only a shadow of their former selves.
Absolutely.
And I think you also parody that really well.
Yeah. I mean, because a friend and I were talking about, actually we were looking at a dress in a window, and it was a white dress and very frilly. And my friend turned to me and he said, "It's the Barbie comeback dress." You know, after she finds God or goes to the Barbie Betty Ford clinic or whatever, you know, that this is the dress she will be wearing when she comes back.
Were you ever afraid of becoming the kind of club performer that you parody?
I think so. I mean, I had more fears of that at the beginning. There was a whole period, I couldn't trace how many years ago, I mean, since I've been doing this about 10 years, I would probably say it's within those first three or four, or any time, including yesterday, when I've had misgivings about maybe I'm not making the right career choices. But especially at the beginning, you wonder if, you know, if I could develop that sort of what I call that stand-up Tai Chi of slickness and, "Hi, how you doing? Where are you from?" You know, if I could mold myself into that personality, would I be farther along? And I see a lot of performers doing that.
You do, in your performance, a great parody of a one-person show.
Thank you. I'm so glad people like that piece.
I think it's great. The show is about a Croatian poet and goat herder and her aunt Rulia. Is this intentionally a send-up of one-person shows?
Oh, absolutely. It's a parody that I've been wanting to do for a number of years, probably since The Belle of Amherst. I love sort of bad historical dramas.
Yeah.
I think that the one-person show is just can be a very funny form, especially when it's taken that earnestly. And that there are just there's something about a certain style of acting that is, to me, horrifying, that is somehow accepted within that form. And my biggest joy in that piece, other than the fact that they got sort of the historical jokes and just the silliness of the whole thing, was that they did, at least some audiences, but most of them actually, got the acting jokes, which was really a great joy to me.
Walking along the road of life, I hadn't journeyed very far when someone pulled over. His name was Death. I didn't know he had a car.
In your show, you take a couple of swipes at mimes.
Yes.
But I have to say here that you're really a very good mime yourself.
I know. I did study it.
So tell me, why do you hate mimes?
It's that horrible poignancy that just drives me insane. That life is broken down into this sort of, you know, these simplistic scenarios where, you know, oh, the wind sort of blows you and then a butterfly comes along. I just find something horrifying about that. To me, it's like all the smile stickers. It's the same sort of sentiment.
When you're creating a character and you're still in the stages of forming the character and you have to see that character in your mind's eye,
mm-hmm.
are you seeing that person that you're doing the character of, or are you seeing yourself in the role of that character?
No, I see the person.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That, again, as far as the technique itself goes, it's something that was taught to me by this mime improvisation teacher, that there's this mime technique called image work where you basically neutralize your body. As much, it means you're relaxed, you know, but that you actually, the first thing you imagine is that you have no features, sort of like the pod people in Invasion of the Body Snatchers before they took anyone else on. And then you picture in your mind whoever it is you're going to be taking on, whether, you know, we work from animal images or stuff, but, you know, in this case, people. And then you very slowly start to transform into them and try to take as much of their body into yours. I mean, that's certainly the way I found the nun. It's the way I found Barbie. It's the way eventually I have to do this work on every character, because you find one part of your body that really, really has that character in them. It can be something in your chest. It may be something you're doing with your hands, a way you're holding something. And by hanging onto that, you can usually get the whole character's physical life.
Well, your mime teacher really created a monster.
I think so.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's over. Thank you.
Jeffrey Essman performs this month at the club at La Mama in New York.
I guess you figured out by now that I'm the child of an alcoholic. It's all right. I've come to terms with it by choosing a career in which I'm constantly seeking the approval of people who are drinking. Yeah, and besides, I mean, there's worse things in life than watching someone you love destroy themselves. There's mine.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Usually at this time, you tell us what stories are coming up on All Things Considered.
Uh-huh.
But today, I thought maybe you could share some behind-the-scenes secrets about how the show's put together.
Here's a behind-the-scenes secret. Would you believe that when All Things Considered, 90 minutes of it, begins every day, as it is going to shortly, we have never, to my knowledge, in the 10 years I've been here, had the whole 90 minutes, the entire program, all edited, listened to, and ready to go at the time that the program begins. That's all going on after we start the program.
Well, there's probably a news story breaking as we speak, mm-hmm. So I'll let you go. We'll stand by and see how today's show turns out. All Things Considered is coming up from National Public Radio. Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Updike has a new novel out. It's called S. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
S is John Updike's third rewrite of Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. The first, A Month of Sundays, told the story from Dimmesdale the clergyman's point of view. The second, called Roger's Version, gave us the side of Chillingsworth, the cuckold. S is all about Sarah, a 42-year-old modern-day descendant of the original Hester Prynne and the original New England Puritan theocracy. She is married to a very chilling man named Worth, and so on. Updike, it seems to me, is more interested in Hawthorne than the rest of us are. He may even be more interested in adultery than the rest of us are. S, however, once it leaves New England for the American Southwest, is a very funny comedy of sexual and metaphysical manners about a woman who wants to be a pilgrim. Most of the fun is at the expense of pseudo-Buddhists who set up shop and sell T-shirts in an America desperate to lose weight and find God. But a lot of it is also at the expense of Sarah and her upper-middle-class Radcliffe smarty pants notions of what women's lib is all about. Sarah leaves her philandering surgeon husband and their North Shore Boston home, with half the family's liquid assets, to sign on at a commune in the Arizona desert, where she will hoe artichokes, pour cement, take dictation, and sleep with anybody male or female who promises to help her get rid of her inconvenient ego. She posts letters and tapes to her husband, mother, daughter, dentist, psychiatrist, and best friend. From them we gather that the commune, with its shopping malls and fabrics factory and designer therapies and a franchise line in health foods and massage parlors, is as fraudulent as its guru, the sex-starved Arhat. And Updike, a card-carrying Episcopalian, is wickedly impatient with the wisdom of the East, even though he does have a gleeful time playing around in the language of another religion, like a kid in a wading pool. Instead of submerging or dispersing or whatever else she's supposed to do to her ego to achieve Satori, what Sarah does is bounce, more like Huck Finn than anybody in a book by Hawthorne. S is likely to annoy feminists almost as much as Updike's The Witches of Eastwick did. He just can't help himself. His love of women, so often declared in interviews, somehow always sounds in fiction abstractly patronizing, even when it's finely tuned. Sarah, for instance, reflects on womanhood and, quote, its daily burden of constant vague expectation and of everything being just slightly disappointing compared with what one knows one has inside oneself waiting to be touched off. It's rather like being a set of pretty little logs that won't quite catch fire, isn't it? This is lovely, but also rather condescending. Aren't they cute, waiting there so wistfully? On the other hand, S will be much more offensive to serious Buddhists than to women. Updike was a lot more respectful of Jews in his Beck books, and of African Muslims in The Coup. After a couple of hundred pages, we begin to wonder, what's so hilarious about Sanskrit? Why not make fun of Kierkegaard or St. Teresa? Be warned, but also be amused.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed S by John Updike. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll talk with Pierre Dulaine and Yvonne Marceau, the founders of the American Ballroom Theater. They're keeping alive the traditions of ballroom dance. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a recording of famed operatic tenor Placido Domingo, only this time he's not singing operas, he's performing popular songs like Maria and Yesterday. And we'll hear from Fresh Air's language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.